creature, wounded, diseased, and enraged, took revenge on the murderers. She cut off their food supply and then waited while they consumed each other.
The grinding has broken out in him.
The polar ice caps have melted, and the earth lies beneath a watery grave. Those who survived have adapted to a new world. Water World.
Climate change is a real and serious issue. Well, the Earth's climate has changed throughout history. Most of these slight changes are caused by small variations in the Earth's orbit. But climate change as we know it today is characterized by an abrupt increase in the Earth's temperature. It is estimated to have gotten 1.2 to 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit warmer in just the last century. 10 out of the last 13 years were the warmest on record. 97% of climate scientists agree that this new tendency is not caused by the variations of the Earth's orbit, but rather very likely caused by human activities. That means you and me.
Yikes. I mean, is it just me or is it hard to tell where the sci-fi versions of climate change end and the real one begins? We started with No Blade of Grass, an apocalyptic tale from 1970, and moved through 1995's Waterworld, flowing seamlessly into the very real challenges we now face, as described by Bill Nye the Science Guy, for educational purposes. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're reading up on climate change in two aisles of the library, fiction and nonfiction. Our bibliophiles will be recommending some of the best books out there, but I want to start by talking with Anthony Shifei Shu. He's with us from UMKC's English department, and he studies contemporary American science fiction. Hi, Anthony.
Good morning.
On some level, it is unsurprising that climate change would pop up on the radar of science fiction writers in an urgent and, like, predominant way. But is there anything about how it's being portrayed that you think is remarkable?
Yeah, I think one thing is that you can kind of think about its portrayals in terms of those that are concerned with the science aspect of climate change. In other words, different kinds of strategies to address the urgent issues of the day. Then there are the more speculative pieces that try to think about climate change in relationship to social groups, political divisions, and ways forward in terms of dealing with the kinds of challenges that we face.
What do social groups and political divisions have to do with it? I mean, I get that on some level, but, like, there are few issues that more than climate change are bound to affect everyone, you know, kind of
absolutely
indiscriminately at some point down the road.
Right. Well, there are certain ways that you can represent reality that deal with how certain groups, let's say an urban community, deals with climate change, where we have perhaps larger fluctuations in terms of temperatures for the summertime, to perhaps groups that live on islands and who are experiencing these days higher ocean levels, for example. So, you know, when thinking about groups, I think authors are really interested, first of all, in what's immediate to them. But I also think that they're attempting to show, you know, it's a universal problem, climate change, but at the same time, it's something that can affect people in different ways at different moments and different places as well.
I want to get back to that a little bit more, but I'm curious about whether there are other times in history or, like, other examples of fiction past where, like, where fact and fiction converged in this kind of really timely, topical, urgent way.
Yeah, you know, it's I wasn't quite familiar with the term climate fiction or cli-fi until a few months ago. And so
it's suddenly in use.
Absolutely. And I could find references back 3 or 4 years ago to the term. And it makes you do a bit of a re-inventory of literature to try to make sense of what's going on. So there are some representations that aren't necessarily science fiction that go 100 years back or even further. The one that comes to mind most would be John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, trying to portray the Dust Bowl. And
interesting, because I think of that in such economic terms.
Right, yeah. And so I always suggest for people, if they don't want to read all of Grapes of Wrath, because it's a big book, at least read the first chapter.
This is like the Depression-era journey of a family trying to get to California during the Dust Bowl.
That's right. It's kind of a documentary in some ways of what are called the Okies from Oklahoma going to California. And so they're dealing with the overexhaustion of the soil, which blows away in the Midwest, in our region, basically. But, you know, you read the first chapter, and actually what's interesting about how Steinbeck portrays nature, it portrays it in an active sense. In other words, that it's an actor upon humans, but also that there's a certain kind of delicacy to it, but also harshness to it that we have to come to terms with. And so certainly escape is one of the terms that that the Joads are forced to confront.
It is going to cause me to think really differently, to process the idea of Grapes of Wrath as science fiction.
Maybe not quite, but maybe we could say climate fiction without a speculative edge, huh. I guess we could say. And I know that I'm more apt not to talk about the nonfiction side, which I think we're also going to talk about.
Yeah, we are.
But you know, what I would say is that in terms of the speculative side, you could see from Jules Verne to, let's say, even more contemporary writers like Margaret Atwood or Kim Stanley Robinson, there's been constant attention trained toward the relationship between people and the environment. Those books tend not to focus so much on the mechanics of climate change in as much as they do the kinds of shifts or strategies that people are employing or dealing with to make sense of this world, but also to move forward.
I once read this book called The Dreams Our Stuff Is Made Of, How Science Fiction Conquered the World, and it was a mind-blowing nonfiction account of how the technology imagined in science fiction has historically fueled real-world innovation. And that's kind of regardless of whether various authors' visions had been utopian or dystopian when it came to that technology. But it seems like this turns that concept on its head in a way, because this is the opposite. Climate change is a thing we are told is supposed to happen. And here is science fiction processing that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that comes to mind when you were mentioning that is that there are novels that are set actually in space. So you wouldn't necessarily think they comment on Earth, but certainly all science fiction is concerned with the present, our present.
Yeah. And why did people leave the Earth? I mean,
exactly right. So there are certainly reasons for it, and those reasons often are climate change related or population related. But one thing that's really interesting about the technology or the technological aspect, and we call that hard science fiction, that science fiction concerned mostly with technological innovation. Authors develop certain, they imagine certain strategies that that scientists could or directions that scientists could go toward on Earth. So, for example, Kim Stanley Robinson in 2132, it imagines solar panels being affixed or orbiting planets in order to concentrate or prevent the sun from hitting certain areas in the solar system, right? So to provide energy or to protect planets. And so certainly with the depletion of the ozone layer, which we've been dealing with, that might be a really intriguing way to kind of think about solving a certain problem.
Are today's authors predominantly envisioning fictional solutions to the problems brought about by global warming, or the absence of solutions, as in a truly devastating, apocalyptic end to life as we know it on planet Earth?
Yeah, that sounds like a Hollywood trailer. I really like it.
Thank you.
Yeah. What I would say is that science fiction tries not to be hopeless about it. So there's always a gesture toward a kind of not necessarily total resolution, but a way of going forward with life. But I guess what I would say is that the way that authors seem to imagine a way forward is through a kind of maybe political revision, right? In other words, they imagine the political world and the political debates that we have.
These are the tools we have?
The tools we have, the people participating in them, for example, the institutions like Congress or the executive branch, they try to imagine those differently. And so what happens a lot of times in these texts is that, the more dire predictions are the ones where our political reality is just transferred into the present. We have the same kind of left-right divisions. Some authors are really experimental, trying to think about different kinds of political parties that can emerge in response to not only all social crises, but especially climate change. In a way, it's levying a judgment. What they're saying, these authors are saying, is that a solution to climate change cannot come from our present political institutions. It has to come from a new set of practices and thoughts.
Well, let's bring someone else in on this. Jake Vail is a librarian with the Lawrence Public Library, and his series of blog posts on cli-fi, or climate fiction, caught our attention. Hi, Jake.
Hi.
So it all started for you with a book you picked up called The Story of Your Life, which has been infiltrating your reading, as you put it, ever since.
Yes and no. This particular blog post started with that, and I read that before the movie Arrival came out. Of course, Arrival is based on that. But as I mentioned in that blog post, what I found really intriguing about the story by Ted Chiang is the way he plays with a sense of time.
Well, wait. Let's stop, because I want you to tell us basically about the story of your life so that the listeners can follow what you're talking about. So tell me about the story of your life.
Okay, short version is Earthlings are suddenly confronted by alien ships hovering above the Earth, and this will sound really familiar if you saw the movie, and they don't know anything about the aliens. So basically the plot boils down to trying to communicate with these beings, trying to figure out why they're here, whether they're here, whether they're friendly or not, and if they have any message for us, perhaps.
So what did this story get you thinking about climate change?
Well, in a roundabout way, it's because of the way the story played with the reader's sense of time. And I think a lot of cli-fi stories also do that. They're using, well, some of them, a lot of them are written in the past, and they're using speculations into the future to write a story in the present. And for that to really work, you have to get your imaginations going so that it doesn't seem so outlandish, you just discard it. And some of the titles that Anthony just mentioned and some of the other titles that are out there, I think, do a really good job of engaging the reader's imagination. They're essentially telling a new story, and part of that, back to your question, has to do with playing with our sense of time.
Why? I'm not sure I totally follow what playing with our sense of time has to do with it. Wouldn't all speculative fiction take something about the present and try to tweak it into a believable, not-so-distant future?
Sure. I think that's true. So the difference here being what it's taking about the present is the situation we're encountering with climate change.
So the subject matter just puts a different kind of spin on it?
I'd say so. And some of the authors, I'm thinking of a writer whose name is Paolo Bacigalupi. He's sort of incorporated both. He looks to the future, writes about speculative fiction that includes pretty outlandish elements, but they're not so outlandish that you discard them. For example, he's got genetically engineered animals helping power our economic system, physically power them, since we've gone beyond oil, for example.
Huh. You know, it's interesting to me, like something, when I think about playing with time and dealing with catastrophe, I feel like just psychologically the opposite thing happens a lot. When we already find ourselves in kind of a scary situation, a lot of people will try to start undoing pieces of the past. Do you see any fiction in your reading that plays with time in that way? Like, can we go, like, the going back and changing bad decisions?
Frankly, I can't think of anything. Can you give me an example of what you're thinking about?
No, except my own brain, which tries to undo bad decisions when faced with a daunting reality.
Well, the authors that I'm sort of stumbling across that I find really intriguing are, in fact, going the opposite direction. They're looking forward. They're concerned about, I think, what we're living with now, what we're about to live through, at least their take on it. And they're spinning these tales of different futures. I should just mention that I'm coming at this sort of from a nonfiction angle. I'm mostly
right.
A nonfiction reader. And the cli-fi or science fiction, even before cli-fi, titles that I've read, I've just sort of stumbled across through talking with people, through reading about online or through other books. And so I don't feel like I have a really broad engagement with those at this point.
Right. You've written about how your dipping into science fiction has affected how you read certain works of nonfiction. And you've mentioned titles like The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable by Amitav Ghosh. Can you tell me about that book?
Yeah. Amitav Ghosh writes both fiction and nonfiction. And this one really grabbed me, mostly because of the beginning, how he lays out the rest of the book. And this sort of gets back to the discussion we were having about the sense of time, because he's very historically versed. He talks about how he arrived at his current presentation by looking at how we being also a very global community, have encountered these changes. And I happened to read that at the same time I read John Pfeffer's book, Splinterlands, and I think they overlap quite a bit. Even though Splinterlands is fictional and Amitav Ghosh is nonfiction.
Tell me about Splinterlands.
John Pfeffer is looking at the future not too far off, actually, and looking at how political regimes and nations that we know now are splintering. And his take on it is that he also is looking at the past and has said also in that book that, for example, following the world wars, nations were divided. Following the fall of the Soviet Union, nations were divided. Now what we're going to see is nations continuing to be divided, but maybe not in such a political sense, but economically and especially because of climate change, which is to say unpredictably.
So this brings us back to the role of politics in these environmental stories, be they fictional or not. And Anthony, you have sort of a specialty in studying how different groups of people, different minority groups in particular, in American writing are portraying science fiction versions of an American future. And I can't help but wonder how you think an author's race or nationality or just background more generally could influence these visions, because as unifying as you would think climate change would be, it's not.
Right. So, you know, the first thing that comes to mind are books by Octavia Butler, who, you know, everyone points to as, one of the most significant what we call Afrofuturist writers. And what I would say is that she certainly is concerned with what she would probably characterize as the devolution of America, you know, socially, environmentally, especially socially and politically, but also environmentally. A lot of her formulations about, you know, addressing the issue seem to be, I'm thinking of her books, Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, seem to point to space as the way forward. And it's something that's really interesting, because if you study it in terms of Afrofuturism, which is just the study of African-American literature and cultural productions that have addressed science fiction issues, goes back to the 19th century. And so there's a long tradition of African-Americans attempting to imagine a future, certainly, from the 19th or parts of the 20th century, free from Jim Crow. And so that's certainly a science fiction kind of tale, but also something that's separated from maybe what we call the corrupting influence of earthly concerns, right? So space becomes the objective, because in space there's a kind of liberation. Perhaps there's a transference of Africa being kind of a symbol of liberation back in the late 19th, early 20th century, to space being a place where things are still being negotiated. And I think that negotiation is something that's interesting for those writers.
Anthony Shifei-Shu with us from UMKC. Thank you.
Thanks.
And Jake Vail with us from the Lawrence Public Library. It's been great meeting you today.
Thank you very much.
Up next, the bibliophiles have some titles to help us wrap our minds around environmental catastrophe, both real and imagined. We want to know what's on your bookshelf, too. Call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, Central Standard. We'll be right back. We're back. It's the Bibliophiles on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's theme is climate change and environmental catastrophe in fiction and nonfiction. In other words, just another Monday morning. Call 816-235-2888 with the book that either scared you or gave you hope. That's 816-235-2888. The bibliophiles are Katie Stover from the Kansas City Public Library. Hi, Katie.
Good morning, everyone.
And Mark Luce is with us from the Barstow School. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
We are also joined by Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, a freelance writer based in Topeka, Kansas. Her writing appears in both the Kansas City Star and the Huffington Post. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Gina. Good to be here.
Okay, so first of all, Katie, as a librarian, are people seeking out climate change narratives more than they used to?
Seems to be, simply because that is a hot topic in the news, and authors are smart about looking at the news and getting inspired by what's happening in their world and then dropping it into fiction. There's a lot of nonfiction, of course, about various topics that are concerning all of us right now, whether it's dystopia, war, climate fiction, environmental fiction. What's great about novelists is that they take these concepts and they drop them into a situation where everyday people can understand how these terrible things affect your everyday life.
It's like you can imagine yourself in that scenario.
Yes, that's what novelists are trying to do. They want you to feel what could really happen on the, you know, the most basic level if the world stopped revolving, or, you know, what does all this logging of mountains look like? What happens if we lose water in the American Southwest? And those are things that we talk about, big topics that get talked about in the news, and we listen to them at home and we think, yeah, but it's not happening here. Well, what would happen if it really was happening right now to maybe your in-laws in Phoenix?
So start us off with a reading recommendation from the fiction shelf.
I'm going to go with Water Knife by Paolo Bacigalupi. I hope I'm saying that. This was a book that we chose for the Kansas City Star's FYI book group because it was really scary. It's an environmental thriller. The author is imagining what it's like if there is no more water available in the American Southwest. And Phoenix is a desert. It's crumbling. And the only place that's getting water that's any sort of paradise, if you will, is, of course, Las Vegas. And this is also a little bit of a legal thriller because it turns on who in the American Southwest owns the water rights.
This makes me think of the movie Chinatown.
Yes, it should. And a lot of those movies, you're thinking, well, maybe not. It couldn't happen. But then you read this book and you think, yes, it really could happen. Even though it's not happening right now, the author is talking about the lack of water and what happens if lawyers step in and they cut off water rights to a city.
A
city in a desert. There are legalities to consider. So you've got a couple of mobsters here, but not really. You've got some environmental terrorists running around in this book, and you've got immigrants, and you've got families that are just decimated, and your homeless look completely different from the homeless that we see today.
How?
Because it's first of all, it's just anybody who's working. Anybody who's working, you can't, if there's no water running into your home, then pretty much everybody becomes homeless. And water also takes on, it becomes so monetized. It becomes so expensive. There are times in this book where people can go and fill so many bottles of water for so much money. And you have to have so many credits on a card that you plug into this machine and it spits out dirty, barely potable water. And you're pretty much pulling water enough just to ingest. No, don't even think about cleaning. There's no plants, so you can't grow food because there's no water to water the plants to grow a garden. And it's really eye-opening to read this thriller.
I mean, I don't want to be like a spoiler alert person here, but maybe spoiler alert as I ask you, does it have a happy ending?
It has a satisfactory ending.
Okay. I like that. I like that.
Mark right. knows what I mean when I say that.
So this is called The Water Knife.
The Water Knife, Paolo Bacigalupi.
Mark Luce,
yes.
How are your high school students relating to this topic, the topic of climate change and possible environmental catastrophe, as readers?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know that that would be like the thing at the top of their charts at this
really?
Point. No. I think...
Anywhere on their charts?
I think they're much more... They get all excited about... Like, once high school kids discover dystopia, like, it becomes, like, an all-consuming sort of thing.
But can't a dystopia be, like, driven by environmental problems?
I think so. I think the couple that, you know, most of the kids will read... I mean, everybody reads 1984, and then some of them read Brave New World, and we'll read The Road, right, which has those kind of concerns. But I think, in general, it's like they kind of almost... take that sort of climate change and like potential destruction almost for granted. Like, oh, here's this thing that's going to happen at some point.
So there's no suspense in it? God, that's depressing.
I don't know. I don't know if there is or not. I mean, I think, you know, in The Road, they always kind of want to know what caused the apocalypse, but then they realize it doesn't matter what caused the apocalypse. It's just that the apocalypse happened and that there is no... You know, the water's dirty and there are no trees and there are no fish and there's no wildlife.
Oh, my gosh.
And I think it freaks them out a little bit. But I don't know that they actively – I don't know that they actively consider climate while reading.
So let's say you were going to try and get one of your students to relate to this topic as a reader. What – of the selections you've brought in today, are you most likely to recommend to a high schooler?
Or to a high schooler. At college, I have a way better answer.
I'll take both. How about
okay.
that?
Okay. I think that I would do a couple different things for a high schooler. I think what I would do is I would look at Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, and then I would look at this graphic novel that's called Here. It's by a guy named Richard McGuire. So the Whitman seems to me self-explanatory, the glorification
but let's,
of
it. Let's assume that our readers may not have read this book. So tell me about it as though it's not self-explanatory.
Oh, okay. So Song of Myself, Walt Whitman basically celebrates all things and all people that are in the and all animals and all plants and all rivers, and basically celebrates everything and embraces it all in this kind of wild romp through America. And it's absolutely, like, on one level, it's totally insane and it's just so much fun. And so he will.
And nature is a big part of it.
Nature is a huge part of it. He talks about all kinds of different animals, all kinds of different plants, all kinds of different people, right? At home on the hills of Vermont or in the woods of Maine, right? Comrade of Californians, comrade of free Northwesterners, right? It's all about comrades in nature, really. And so I think that shows a baseline sort of appreciation and love that you understand sort of that you have to cohabitate with these things around you, and that's the sort of celebrate part. Like, hey, we need to love this. And then I would fast forward to, I think this book came out last year, to Here, which...
A graphic novel. And who is the author?
His name's Richard McGuire.
Is he also the illustrator?
He's also the illustrator, yes. And so this book takes place over billions of years in one location. So imagine your living room. So let's just say it's your living room. And he will look forwards and backwards in time, like all the way back to like 3 million BCE. So it would be your living room and it would show maybe your mantle or something like that. But then there would be a panel within that frame that would show Native Americans in 1609 or dinosaur type things way back BCE. And I think what it shows is how resilient the earth is to people kind of getting in the way. And so I think those two things together would be an interesting way to sort of showcase, not so much like, oh, we need to be scared, but like, let us celebrate this thing that is here.
Hmm.
That's an interesting take on the idea of environment through literature.
Yeah, I just don't. I'm not. To me, it's more like the thing that I like about when the environment makes itself felt in a novel or even to a certain extent in nonfiction. I like the environment being a character. I like that the setting or the place actually serves as a character. And then that kind of, to me, that sort of underlines sort of whatever other themes that are there.
What does it mean for an environment or place to serve as a character?
I always go back to My Antonia by Willa Cather and the planes kind of being a character. The planes are always there. The planes are underlying everything that they do. The planes give them life. The planes give them sustenance.
Yeah,
I mean, in many ways, the
action.
Land. Yeah, the land is, I mean, is kind of a deity, right? The land is gives you those things.
All powerful.
I think, yeah, and even in something like All Quiet on the Western Front, Mother Earth sort of being protector and a place where you're buried. So that's kind of how I just think of it in those terms rather than, oh my goodness, like we're all going to die.
Because fear can be paralyzing.
Yes.
Well, what are the two titles you've just recommended again?
Okay, so one was Song of Myself by Walt Whitman, and then the other one is called Here, and it's by Richard McGuire.
Jeff, talk to me about this topic and how it resonates for you, and then we'll get into one of your recommendations.
Well, it makes me gloomy and not quite ebullient like Walt Whitman. I mean, I think novelists are taking this on because it's omnipresent. We're concerned about climate change. Most of us accept that climate change is real. And I read that Louise Erdrich's upcoming novel, who's written realistic fiction, is going to be science fiction, environmental, a novel where evolution has stopped. I think we might see more of that.
So I want you to talk to us about The Age of Miracles, which you say blurs the line between fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah, The Age of Miracles was Karen Thompson Walker's debut novel in 2012, and it imagines a time in the not-too-distant future where time is elongated, where the gravitational pull of the Earth has slowed down. And the author has said that she was inspired to write this novel by an actual event, the earthquake in Indonesia in 2004, which I guess reportedly chipped a few microseconds off our 24-hour day. Who knew? Did you guys know that?
I didn't know.
Anyway, missing them.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. In this novel, it's not that the days are getting shorter, but the days are getting longer. And this is told from the point of view of Julia, who's on the cusp of turning 12, and it's a coming-of-age novel, and she's noticing Seth, the skateboarder, but she's also noticing that her mom's hair is turning gray and their parents' marriage is strained. But the big backdrop is the environmental catastrophe. The days are getting longer. The days are stretching. Birds drop from the sky. When the days stretch to 30 hours, the president announces that all of a sudden people need to adhere to the circadian rhythm. They have to observe the 24-hour day, whether it means putting blankets over the windows or whatever. So a division erupts between what are called clock timers and real timers. Real timers want to adjust to the new rhythm and go out to the desert, and so all kinds of trouble erupts. What I liked about this book was it takes a real feeling. I mean, we've had a lot of extreme weather and some ominous events, and ramps it and amps it up. And it got glowing reviews. And speculative fiction and also a literary novel. I think the most negative reviews came from snarky people who were mad that she got $1 million advance on her first novel.
Whoa, that is quite
that is
an advance.
But the backstory is that she wrote the book as a working editor at Simon & Schuster in the morning on the way to work on the subway.
Well, she paid her dues, I guess.
I guess.
So the wow. Title and name of the author again?
The Age of Miracles by Karen Thompson Walker. And I think this could be a YA novel.
It is.
For
and,
sure.
And it's fantastic in audio, too, because I reviewed that in audio and was just riveted. It's definitely an adult book for adults, and not just because the protagonist is a 13-year-old. What adults will like about it is are all the things you mentioned, which is the backstory, the framing of it, which is what happens on a political, cultural, personal level when time elongates, time stops, time extends. And it talks, this book gets very realistic, talking about the effects of elongated days on agriculture, on our own popular culture. political spectrum and the personal nature and what happens to your body.
And it has such a hopeful title, though, The Age of Miracles.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, true. But the other thing is that it's sort of it's a metaphor, too, about the way in which time seems to stand still in moments of crisis, personal and political.
Well, let's hear from Julie in Olathe, who has called us at 816-235-2888 with an environmental reading recommendation. Julie, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and strangely enough, I'm in my 50s, and I had never even heard of this book, which surprised me when I read it. I think it was written in the early 60s, and it's a real awakening about what might happen, and it really is an informative. She wrote several other books that weren't quite as informative, but they were all great books. She even had an impact on President Kennedy, and it was a huge bestseller. She was also very criticized for her views. It was pretty intense. The chemical industry attacked her vehemently.
What did you enjoy? I mean, or maybe enjoy is the wrong word, but what spoke to you about Silent Spring in particular?
I think that the pure truth of it and you know, in these times and the fact that I'm a scientist and the science part of it rang true and the fact that it seems like the majority of the government is in fact controlled still by the powers that be that have the money, the big lobby.
Well, Julie, thank you for recommending Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, and we're going to get right back to this conversation. Keep those calls coming at 816-235-2888. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, the Bibliophiles will share more of their recommendations for stirring literature on climate and the environment. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman with the Bibliophiles, Katie Stover, Mark Luce, and Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. We are talking about cli-fi or climate fiction, but not just that. We're talking about the environment and its relationship with literature, past and present. And we just had a call about Silent Spring. That's a classic in some ways of the genre, and I don't want to spend too much more time on it, but Bibliophiles, what's your response to that recommendation?
I think it's a wonderful recommendation. I mean, it's a nonfiction book by a scientist. It's really the first serious book I read about the environment.
That's the book that launched a lot of narrative nonfiction and storytelling in that genre. It's still a classic. People are still reading that, and they're reading it because it's accessible, and they're reading it because Carson has a wonderful style, her word choice. It's poetic, it's suspenseful, it's compelling. She really makes the environment a character.
Let's quickly go to Steve. Steve in Kansas City, I hear you have a provocative question for us.
Hello. Yeah, I don't know if it's provocative so much. The thing I wanted to add into the mix here, just to the radio station, is that I think that it's a little bit, dangerous to be mixing a show on writing about fictional climate change, et cetera, or the mixing of fictional climate change issues with real climate change. And I said to the producer when I talked to him that I just wanted to recommend a couple nonfiction. Actually, they're documentaries. One of them is called 6 Degrees Could Change the World. Actually, that was made by National Geographic back in 2006. So really, if you watched that these days and saw all of the information that was on that documentary back in 2006, well, we're 11 years later. So just, you know, imagine that. Another one is called The 11th Hour. And it's a documentary also about climate change. And pray tell, the young actor named Leonardo DiCaprio produced that. And I just wanted to suggest that to the audience because whether or not high school kids or college kids or whoever are interested in climate change as a fiction or nonfiction issue, does not matter because it is happening. And it's not going to just happen like a book all at one time. I think everybody knows that. It's just a slow process that's happening. And my geology teacher back in college in 1993 said, as we get older, we will hear the phrase climate change and global warming. Started hearing a lot more.
Appreciate your point, Steve. And I want to get some response to the relation, like maybe a tricky relationship here between science fiction's preoccupation with this and the underlying realities that people are trying to get informed about.
I mean, there's a part of me that I think I would politely disagree with Steve. I think there's benefit to having sort of fictional or poetic understanding of cycles of life and understanding sort of how the earth operates. And I think that metaphors in literature, you know, say of rivers or something like this, can be extremely powerful things. And I think too, it's like, where do you draw that line? Like, what other science if we talk about Jurassic Park, can we not talk about, like, where do you draw that line? So to me, like, they seem to me very different things. Like, a nonfiction book about climate change is very different from fiction. And I don't know that any of us would conflate those two in any way, shape, or form.
But I do think the fiction can give an emotional urgency to a serious topic.
Yes, that's what novelists are trying to do when they talk about. When they take current events, trending topics, and drop them into novels, they are focusing on the human connection between this topic and what's going on inside.
One of Steve's concerns was that it's not going to happen all at once like it seems in the novels. Is there an example of a novel that takes a slower approach?
Yes, as a matter of fact. Do I have time to talk
please,
about Annie
yes,
Proulx at Barkskins? Yeah, if I'm not out of order here.
No, please.
Yeah, Barkskins was published last year by Annie Proulx, and it's a doorstopper of a novel. It's 713 pages, and it's about, it really succeeds more as a screed, a polemic about the environment than it does as a nuanced novel. But I would say that it's important. It treats the devastating effects of deforestation across three centuries and centers on two woodcutters. It covers 300 years or Barkskins, and one guy, Rene, marries an American Indian woman and lives a life of integrity, and the other guy, Charles, is very wily, and he founds a timber empire that devolves into plywood, and we follow these characters. And I have to say, it's very dense, incredible detail about woodcutting, about the environment, about trees. When she introduces particularly some of her minor characters, I would say they're a bit wooden, pardon the pun. And at the end, the contemporary add-on is just frankly too preachy. But it's important. She's an 81-year-old author to be reckoned with. This is her fifth novel. She got the Pulitzer for her third novel, The Shipping News, which I think is her best one. But
and this is Annie Proulx?
Annie Proulx, yeah, big one.
Barkskins.
As Mark joked, could save some trees.
Well, let's hear from another one of our callers. We've got Drew and Olathe on the line. Hi, Drew.
Hey, I actually would like to suggest, and I think it's really very much a treatise, it's Blade Runner, and the environment and how degraded it is by basically what I think is implied as nuclear devastation and just how it's destroyed everything. And I would suggest any politician really needs to read these before they ever think of dropping nukes again. It's a very strong warning. The environment's quite a big factor in it. And, of course, with Dick, there's his supernaturalism as well. But the environment is huge. I think it's as influential as Rachel Carson's Silent Spring for those who would actually read it.
Well, let's see what our bibliophiles think about this recommendation.
So the Philip K. Dick novel is Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And I think that it would. I thought of it this morning when I was driving in. That was one I thought of, and I think it does fit in there. The animals, like owning real animals, is a huge status symbol, and most of the animals are mechanical, right? And most of humanity has moved to Mars. And so, and then there's a the conflict basically is the replicants that they're making, the robots they're making are so lifelike and so human-like that basically it's hard to tell the difference between the two, which is kind of, I mean, freaky, but kind of cool.
So this is, do androids dream of electric sheep? And that's the basis of Blade Runner.
The Road by Cormac McCarthy is a wonderful example of the world after a nuclear devastation or just devastation.
So Lydia Millett's O Pure and Radiant Heart imagines the fathers of the A-bomb waking up in 2003 Santa Fe, and J. Robert Oppenheimer is concerned about the cement dystopia and what they've wrought.
Dang. Katie, you have been sort of thumbing through a book that I want to ask you about quickly, The Sign of the Seahorse, or just Sign of the Seahorse, excuse me.
It's The Sign of the Seahorse by Graham Bass, and it's a children's picture book. It's utterly gorgeous, and it is about the destruction of the old reef and the inhabitants of the old reef moving to the new reef. And the destruction of the old reef happens when a poison that is unidentified seeps into the old reef and it kills all of the coral. It kills the environment. And the only reason the residents know this is happening, and the residents are fish and lobsters and shrimp and snails, but they realize that all the seahorses have gone. They've left. So you can imagine what our world would be like if all the birds just all of a sudden disappeared. So this is a children's picture book. It's told in rhyme. It's also a little bit of a mind bender because you're supposed to go through each picture and look for two largely unnoticed shrimps and also a sign of a seahorse. But while you're turning the pages of these utterly gorgeous, colorful, jewel-toned pages.
They are pretty.
The author is weaving a tale about what happens when your home is destroyed by pollution and you have to move and you leave everything behind.
Now, tough to tackle that for children.
Yes, but the author does it in a wonderful way. It's got some high melodrama working in here too. There is a dastardly villain, there is a heroine, and then there's a punk band. So
the title and author of this book,
the title of this is The Sign of the Seahorse by Graham Bass. And it's a gorgeous, gorgeous picture book. And Graham Bass he lives in Australia, and he has a series of picture books that address timely topics, and he drops them in these lovely settings.
Let's hear from Brent in Kansas City. And Brent, I'm sorry, we don't have much time, so we'll have to keep it short. But what's your recommendation?
Okay, I had two. One is, it's an older novel by Michael Niven. It's called Lucifer's Hammer. It's about a asteroid that crashes into Earth. And, you know, it's pretty much changes the entire environment. And it's, you know, and the other one is by John Birmingham. It's a there's an event that it's a trilogy, and there's an event that occurs just over North America, and it pretty much wipes out all life in Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. And it's pretty much how the world copes after, in essence, the United States disappears.
How the human world still inhabited, but just minus the United States?
The majority of the U.S. population, yeah. And it's more of a social commentary on, you know, everybody kind of complains about the U.S. like we're the root of all problems in the world. But when the U.S. disappears, the chaos that ensues,
yeah,
but environmentally and everything after that.
I want to get a little response about just, is it surprising how much of our environmental and climate fiction is social and political?
No, not surprising. The environment impacts both.
No, I'm not surprised at all.
Not at all.
Nobody's surprised. Well, on that note, our time is up. Keep talking about books on our Twitter feed. We're at KCURCST, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, freelance writer, thank you for making the trip in today.
Oh, yes. It was my pleasure.
Katie Stover of the Kansas City Public Library. This has been, I don't know if fun is an appropriate word, but it's been something like that.
Always a delight.
Mark Luce, thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Mark joins us from the Barstow Public School. Listen back to this conversation and pass it along to your friends at kcur.org/Central Standard later today. Tomorrow, tune in for a Central Standard documentary on how the Kansas town of Atchison is caught in the middle between the pull of history and the economic push to catch up to the future. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.